We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia where this podcast was recorded as the first storytellers, the first communities, and the first creators of Australian culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi there, I'm Daniel Moore, and you're listening to Season 4 of the Hearing Architecture Podcast, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. In this episode, I'm speaking with registered architects Ed Lippman, Director of Lippman Partnership, and Peter Sarlos of Sydney East Architects and Special Counsel at M&A Lawyers. In this episode, we discuss a case study regarding moral rights in architecture, in which one of Ed Lippman's projects was involved. Moral rights provisions in Australia's Copyright Act expressly recognise and protect the rights of authorship, including the right of attribution, the right against false attribution, and the right of integrity. Ed and Peter take us through the case study, where another architect was engaged to undertake work that impacted one of Ed's projects, and how he and the other architect addressed his moral rights as the works were undertaken. Let's jump in.
Well, thank you so much, Ed and Peter, for joining me today on the Hearing Architecture Podcast. How are you going?
Very well. Very well. Looking forward to this.
I'm feeling nervous.
I think the question of moral rights is a very important issue for architects, and which is why we're doing this. And maybe I should just start by explaining why Peter's here and what we've been working on together. So Peter is an architect and a lawyer, and I first met Peter when we needed some help with a security of payments problem with a client who hadn't paid their fees, and he was recommended to me by an adjudication organisation as a lawyer, an architect lawyer who could help us with some unscrupulous clients who hadn't paid their fees. And that was a very successful action. We got paid and the matter was resolved. So that's how I met Peter. But then a couple of years later, after completing an award-winning building, which I prefer not to mention because I don't want to criticise the client and the organisation, but just to talk about the issue. So a few years later, after the practice completed an award-winning building, which was opened by the Prime Minister's wife and all of that, and I thought I had a happy client, a year or so after that was completed, I heard that they were making alterations to that building, which was awarded and published overseas and locally, and I was surprised that they were doing that without notifying me, but also concerned that the changes would derogate or diminish the value of the building.
Right.
So I immediately called the client. I called Peter as well because we're sensitive souls, us architects and all people, but at the same time I didn't want to overstep my my rights, and I just wanted to know what I can and can't do under the circumstances. One thing to have your feelings hurt, but we're all, we can't criticize people for hurting our feelings, but we also have some legal rights. So
yeah, well, I think this is a really good opportunity maybe for Peter to explain a little bit about what moral rights are, because I think people who might not be as familiar with architects or architecture as architects might be, moral rights is quite an important part of, an architect's ownership of their work. So, Peter, do you want to explain what moral rights are and why it's so important to architects, and how it can sometimes upset our feelings if the moral rights that we have aren't acknowledged properly on a building?
Well, firstly, architects are recognised as authors rather than as architects. And they're also tied in with sculptors and other artists And that happens inside the legislation itself.
Right.
But basically, moral rights are a personal right that belong to the individual, not to the company. They're different from copyright, and they absolutely need copyright. Right. You have the right. You have the right of having your name published in relation to the work, and there's provisions for that in the AIA Client Architect Agreement 2019. It was a bit different in the earlier versions, and some of the things that I found difficult in the early versions have been taken out, and now there's a clear exercise of moral rules that allows you to exercise your moral rights.
Right.
Now, moral rights basically impose a responsibility on the owners of the buildings not to derogate from the owners, the designers, or the architects or sculptors' rights to moral rights to protect the author's reputation.
Right, gotcha.
Can I just go back a step before we do this, which is very useful, just to explain the background to this, which I've only learned recently, and that is to do with the Berne Convention. So Australian legislation is based on Berne Convention, which is an international assembly that took place in 1886 in Switzerland, and the goal of that was to create a set of legal principles to protect artists and artistic work. So 195 countries in the world 14 out of 195 countries in the world, all but 14 have signed up to that set of principles, including Australia. And as Peter says, it provides architects, musicians, poets, film directors, painters to control how their works are used and under what terms. So in Australia, the Federal Act, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, it was legislated in 1968, I think.
The Copyright Act was legislated in 1968. Moral rights provisions were only before Parliament. First came before Parliament in 1996 after a fairly exhaustive study by the Copyright Law Reform Commission. And it was only finally brought in 2000, was passed by Parliament in 2000.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So the 1996 had, this is an important issue, because 1996 had in it a provision that allowed an author or an artist to waive their moral rights. That was objected to very strongly by the ABC and a number of other organisations, and that was challenged to consent.
Well, before we come to that, let me just again, just the background I think is important. The copyright laws and the moral rights provision of the copyright laws give building owners or provide building owners with the right to alter and add to their buildings. But the moral rights provisions of the Copyright Act requires building owners to consult in good faith with the architect before they do it. Or maybe I'm not probably putting that legally in the right frame, but it provides architects with the opportunity to consult in good faith prior to changes being made to their building. And the problem that can sometimes occur, and it happens very often to architects, is that people want to change their building. In Sydney, it's a big problem because there's a mindset here that buildings are merchandise, and once you pay for that, you can do whatever you want to do. It's your building; you paid for it. You know, no one's going to tell me. You know, this is the attitude here. It's not, probably not as toxic in Melbourne, but I've paid for this. I own it. I'll do whatever I want to do with it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as toxic, but I feel like in Australia, our architectural literacy might not be as strong in other countries. So I don't think a lot of people just aren't aware what responsibilities they might have when they are buying a building. And
That's actually part of the problem. It's part of the problem. And the important thing is, we can't expect people to know this thing, but I think we as architects, we need to know what the rules of the game are so that we can educate our clients and the public. And I think, look, it's very hard to private housing, very difficult to execute this, but when we're talking about public buildings where there's community value in these buildings, it's not a question of hurting the architect's feeling or a sort of subjective thing, but I'm of the view that it's very important that we protect our heritage. And and the best person to protect a public building and the quality of that architecture is the architect. And that's not to say that the owner of the building hasn't got the right to change it. And I think it's very important that we recognise that right. But the architect, and sometimes buildings change hands, the owner may change too. However, I think somehow for the sake of our community heritage, I think a lot of buildings can be lost, and they are being lost and damaged and destroyed and derogated because the value of the architecture is not being respected.
Can I just want to add something here?
Mm-hmm.
It's important to realise that moral rights in relationship to buildings has been singled out to be different from the moral rights of all other forms of authorship or artistic endeavour.
Wow.
And under Section 195AT, which was added after the Act was promulgated, restrictions on an architect's rights or an artist's rights in any work related to building have been severely restricted. And those rights are abused. And that's a totally separate subject that gets back to how the legal profession operates in terms of contractual arrangements between the time that the bill was passed in Parliament and the time that it was promulgated. I think it must have been during the third reading speech, not the second reading speech. And was put in to restrict or to enhance the owner's rights over the rights of the artists.
Right. Okay.
Both parties have rights, but what this has done, it has allowed the legal profession to write contracts which I don't like using this word, but which I think intimidate arts and architects, artists, authors, in the same way the building profession modify contracts to intimidate contractors and subcontractors in the way they write contracts, because there's a common law philosophy that says a contract is a contract, and whether it's a good contract or a bad contract, you're bound by the contract. And that's where the power game occurs.
Okay, let me just jump in here, because I don't want to jump into the legal issues too quickly. I think the background needs to be well understood. So I think Peter's right in saying that some of these contracts and that we're often asked to sign, where we've been asked to waive our rights or to exercise our rights, I think the problem from a practicing architect's perspective is that the building owner has a right. They do own the building, so they obviously have rights, and they use the building. And they should be allowed to make changes to the building, as I said earlier. There's no doubt, no question about that. You know, we're not trying to freeze architecture. Even a great award-winning building like the Opera House is being modified. And in my opinion, that is completely valid and necessary if buildings are to endure for a long time. So But we, you know, we can't get overly precious about it. However, the consultation is important. Now, the problem that seems to me that occurs, especially in the property industry, is that often architects are perceived as being a problem. If a building is awarded, that's an even bigger problem for an owner. Or if it's heritage listed, that's perceived as a big problem for the owner because it means that they can't do anything with it and that any changes to the building are being vetted by another authority, and it restricts their ability to do anything with it. But I think the problem for architects is that we have to be seen to be working with the property owner and not arguing and fighting against them. And so there seems to be, I don't know, I'm not sure that it's as bad in Melbourne as it is in Sydney, but there's a tendency for developers to perceive architects as a threat and a problem and not people who are facilitators. And really, it's a dialogue both ways. Clients need to understand architects, and architects need to understand clients, and that usually works pretty well. But the reason that these contracts come about where there's an attempt to restrict the architect is because the client doesn't trust the architect. They don't want the architect to have these rights because it may conflict with their objectives. And that's the problem. So I'm working, and there are some very good examples of in Sydney, a recent one which I often cite because I don't want to just complain about developers. I don't, you know, obviously, you know, they have an important role to play in the built environment. But a very good example in Sydney is some changes that have been made to the MLC Centre in Sydney, which is a Harry Seidler development built in the 70s. A big building with a lot of office space as well as a ground plane with retail space. And it was awarded. And it's been recently renovated significantly. And it has been made better. And I think that is a brilliant example and of how the original architect can work and should work with a building owner, and that building has changed hands. It's now owned by Dexus. The original architect was engaged, was consulted. They were not commissioned to do the work. It was done by another firm, Woods Bagot, but Seidler's office was consulted and they worked with Woods Bagot. And I think the outcome from everyone's point of view has been an improvement commercially, architecturally. So, you know, this idea that the architects are fighting the developers want to make money, the architects are just interested in aesthetics, that's not the case. That's not the case. A good architect will help a developer make money and deliver a beautiful building. I don't see any issue with that. But
yeah, following the letter of the law of moral rights, as that project seems to have done, it appears that it's not necessarily a drawback for the owner and the developer. It can actually benefit them in a big way. So
yes. Well, that's the message that we need to put out there, that we can help the developer achieve the objectives without eroding the architectural value.
It's an obligation under the Act, under the moral rights provisions of the Copyright Act, that the author, in this case the architect, is notified when someone intends to modify the development. That's whether or not consent's been given. That's an obligation.
Right.
Now, from the architect's point of view, who are the persons commissioned to do the work, because it used to be that when an architect has designed a building, he had a moral obligation to the other architect to notify the original architect if he was asked to modify the work. I've been in that situation, and sometimes I've made friends with the architect that I was replacing. Sometimes I made an enemy or a manifest. But still an obligation. Now, in Ed's situation, the architect who took over from him, who
Let me just explain a bit more carefully.
Before we get into your particular case, Ed, I think that was a really great clarification, Peter. I guess my one question, which I think is quite interesting in the Harry Seidler case, is when Harry Seidler has passed on, but now his officers are still operating in some way to respect the work of Harry Seidler. Do you know anything about how that might have been handled at that time? And I can cut this out if you don't know more about it, but I think for people who, for officers that might not be as, trusts of an architect who has passed away, I find that quite an interesting
thing. I'm involved in that sort of situation at the moment, in Victoria, of all places.
All right.
When it says it's different in Victoria and it may be different in Queensland, that's not the case. There's a different nuance, but it's still a problem. And there's an architect who is fighting in Geelong, who's fighting the same law firm, or I think it's the same law firm, that I've got a dispute with in Victoria, who have taken that corporate view of the legislation and advising the clients on a corporate basis.
But in answer to Daniel's question.
Yeah, I'm just about to do it. Moral rights, and there's a slight difference depending on when, moral rights came into being before or after the coming in of the Act. But basically, moral rights last for 70 years.
Right.
And the difference is, in some cases, it lasts for longer than 70 years. Don't know this exactly. Not one that comes up all the time.
But hang on, doesn't moral rights exist during the lifetime of the architect?
Yes.
And for 70 years after their death?
That's the one that's modified. Depending, is there a slight nuance? But
that's what Daniel was asking. He was so as long as the architect is alive, they own the moral rights. After their death, it's their estate. So in the case of Seidler, even though he's passed away, his wife has inherited those rights.
It's not the firm. It's not the firm that this leads back to the personality. It's the individual that has the right, not the corporate personality.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be a wife. It could be children.
And they maintain that right till they pass away. And when they pass away, the 70 years after they pass away, it falls into the hands of their estate. So it could be the wife, the husband, or the child, the children, daughter or son, whatever. But that's how it operates. So it doesn't belong to the
community. It's personal.
Yeah.
Right. And that's one of the complications, because the company cannot hold moral rights, although sometimes the company can act on behalf of the owner of the moral rights.
Interesting.
And in the case of partnerships, it's a bit more complicated too, because a lot of architects these days are doing work in collaboration with other firms. I've done that too. So I'm not sure who owns the moral rights in that case.
The Act tries to address that. When you enter into a when moral rights becomes an issue, the author, the specific person who designed the building, is the person who has the moral rights. That's, you can't contract.
Can it be more than one person?
No.
Okay. Because that's a tricky one.
That is a tricky one.
Because there are many projects these days that are done as collaborations between firms.
Well, you both hold, if there's a collaboration, and every architectural project involves a team, so it's not an individual thing.
Yeah.
And the engineers can have a question of moral rights on the project because of their engineering work.
Yeah.
And just to pick the example that Ed picked, or pick a different building, Australia Square, you had Nervi designing the structure and you had Harry Seidler designing the building. Now, both Nervi has moral rights and Seidler has moral rights.
Yeah.
And pick the Opera House. And Ogarup has moral rights over the design of some aspects of the structure. but the concept belongs to Utzon.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. I mean, that's not exactly what we were here to discuss, but it's very interesting because having just attended some talks on this at the Opera House for its 50th birthday, even the building contractor who produced workshop drawings came up with some very ingenious, inventive ideas. So,
and those ideas, he has one
right. Right, and those drawings, which are now in the State Library, it's documented. So whoever is the author of the drawing or the design has a right to protect
them. Yeah, he has the right over the drawings and the physical building or physical part of the building that's come out of it. So every engineer, for as an example, and even subcontractors, may have moral rights. Now, the way you address that, there are two, when you're dealing with consent, under the moral provisions of the Copyright Act, in this section of the Copyright Act, has provisions where if you are an employee, you can be asked to surrender your moral rights absolutely. But if you're the author, if you head the team and you claim the moral right, then that's not an absolute. You can't consent absolutely to the extinguishment of your moral rights.
Okay.
So there are some nuances in there. The problem is that these things haven't been tested, and the lawyers are playing games, the legal profession is playing games.
And it's expensive for architects to execute. And our problem is, well, what I found when, in my case, we called the owner out, advised them, I mean, they hadn't actually done the work yet, but they had council consent to do the work. And I wasn't very happy with the architect who was involved because
if we back up a little bit, if I ask you, I just wanted to ask you a question about that first so I can set you up to tell this story, if that's okay. This is all absolutely fascinating in terms of, you know, who owns the moral rights. And I think, Ed, you actually have experienced a project that you had designed originally and then a different architect was engaged to do some alterations to that project. Do you want to explain what happened on that particular project?
The site that my building sits on is a campus which includes several other buildings. Mm-hmm. One of them is a heritage-listed building. Mm-hmm. Another one was an award-winning building, and my building also became an award-winning building. So it's a site which contains several important, significant buildings. So mine was just the latest one. Mm-hmm. But I was aware that the client had engaged another firm of architects to modify an adjacent building, and that's their right. I had no issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't realise was that in the course of designing the alterations to that old heritage-listed building, they were also briefed to make changes to the courtyard which connected my building to the other building, which was very carefully, and I won a heritage award for the manner in which the two buildings connected and the sensitivity of that. So what I didn't realise was that they were actually making changes to the courtyard and to the building fabric within the courtyard which connected the two buildings. So I heard about it through a consultant who had worked with me, who they engaged with a lighting designer, and I called the client to find out what was happening. They had already been granted the development consent from the local council, but they hadn't engaged the builder and done the work. So I thought, okay, I was concerned, but work hadn't been done yet. My intention was simply to sit down with them, find out what they were doing, and ensure that the building was protected. That was the point. I wasn't trying to stop them doing it or angry that another architect was doing it. That wasn't the motivation. It was just protecting the building. So when I called the client, they were defensive, probably understandably. And I said, look, there is legislation in this country, and what we need to do is to get together with the other architect who I knew not very well, and said, you know, we should talk about it. So, and we promptly did that. And I told them it was important, if we could, sort this out before they let a building contract, to ensure that the architecture was protected. They told me that they would do that. They wouldn't go to tender, and we would, you know, get an opportunity to consult and rectify, which we did. I managed to prevent them changing a very, in my view, well-designed structure. By when I say well-designed, by the engineers, not just myself, but it was a glass canopy, which was a very important part of that space. So that was protected. So we came to a resolution. The other architect and I, they wouldn't touch that. They realised that there was no benefit to changing it. It was expensive. It wouldn't achieve anything, and it would derogate the architecture. And then there was the question of how the two buildings interfaced, which was further discussion. So anyway, look, there was a lot of conversation about it. What really created the problem was, in the middle of that consultation, before it had been resolved, my son-in-law, who works in the building industry, rang me and told me that he was tendering on the project. And I thought he was making a mistake, who didn't know what he was saying. But in fact, he was a subcontractor in the scaffolding business, and he had been asked by a builder to provide a price for the scaffolding of this project. So I immediately realized, okay, the consultation is occurring, but it's not in good faith, which is what the legislation requires. It's clearly not in good faith. So it was going through this exercise with me to pacify, and it was a bit of a sham consultation, because even though they said they wouldn't go to tender, they did, and that then created a dispute where they, I thought, acted improperly. Not in good faith. I was being genuine in my attempt to help them resolve this and to do what they wanted to do without ruining the architecture. And, you know, so that's what happened. And then because of that, legal action, I felt very marginalised and thought, well, the only way that I'm really going to get a good result is to have a third party involved who will, you know, insist on it. And that was very unfortunate. But I'm happy to say that I succeeded in protecting the building, but the client is now managed by a different board and a new CEO, and I'm actually meeting with them next week. And the point of that meeting is to explain to them that there was no ill will on my part, quite the contrary, but also to make them aware of what the rules are and to prevent this happening again, because they've still got a lot of good architecture on their site. And it's not just my building, but I'm also concerned about the quality of architecture generally. And it's a cultural problem, which probably does exist in other countries, but probably less so in places like Scandinavia, that there should be some recognition that architecture has value. And while you can modify buildings, they can be modified well or they can be modified very badly. And the original architect, especially in the case of an award-winning building, should be involved. That's fairly obvious, I would.
Yeah, and I think in terms of the design intent of what you had achieved in your building when it was awarded and applauded for what it did achieve, there are definite reasons there to preserve that. So when it comes down to moral rights and design intent, is that the main thing we're trying to preserve, Peter? Is the original design intent of the work that has now been completed?
What we're trying to preserve is the architect's reputation, and anything that goes against it is what we're trying to do. The Act recognises that what an artist does or what an architect does is a part of that person's ongoing reputation and part of his ongoing economic viability. And by attempting to prevent derogation or manage derogation, it's actually trying to protect reputation. The provisions in 195AT are also trying to protect the economic integrity of a project from the building owner's point of view. Now, there's some legal history to that, which goes back to a decision in the UK in 1970, in which Lord Denning, who's a famous jurist, but not really relevant here, his decision has been followed here by the High Court, which limits the rights of architects specifically to interfere with the economic rights of a developer. So the way the Act tries to compromise between those two extreme positions, it treats them as extreme positions. And the developers, following on from Lord Denning's decision back in 1970, feel that they have some rights in Australia because of the adoption of Denning's decision as part of the common law of Australia. We follow the English common law, and that's how this comes into play. So that's the conflict that we have to address. And that gets back to the conflict that it still exists and it remains unresolved between the meaning of the words consent and the meaning of the words waiver. Because the legal profession treats waiver as consent. They treat them as having the same meaning, and they don't and they can't. And that's something that eventually will need to be tested by the courts. But unfortunately, the cost of this, the cost of protecting your moral rights is, at least in the first few cases.
Well, it's prohibitive.
It's prohibitive.
For most architects.
And we tried, but we didn't get very far to do this to support a claim in the courts through crowdfunding. Ed went as far as the Supreme Court. But we lost on a technical ground.
Well, we didn't lose. We withdrew. We withdrew because the risk.
The financial risk the financial risk associated with fighting at some basic technical issues could have meant that this would have gone on the Court of Appeal and potentially the High Court. The costs involved far outstripped the capacity of an individual architect to challenge. So we tried crowdfunding. We tried to get the support of the Institute. We tried to get the support of other people. We managed to get a little bit of support from people who were interested in the moral rights. It wasn't sufficient to carry it up further. But we got as far as we got an adjudication decision in our favour.
We got a very good adjudication decision, in fact.
And we have been fought very heavily on technical grounds in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And that's why the action was ultimately withdrawn.
Right. Okay.
So it's winnable. It's winnable. But you've got to have the right party. The other one that I'm involved in Victoria at the moment, for example, is up against a local government authority who's the building owner. And to fight it, you're fighting a lawyer and the local government association, and a lawyer is a lawyer who represents local government around Australia. He's fighting on principle, and that's a very difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that we architects need to win a precedent, need to win a legal matter to set a precedent. And I was very tempted to do that, but there's always a risk of losing. I mean, it seemed very clear that this particular client did not consult in good faith and they did everything wrong. But, because of a technicality, we decided not to go for it because they would have appealed and appealed and appealed, it seemed. Mm-hmm. They were quite obnoxious in the way that they were dealing with it. And rather than sitting down with me, they refused to sit down and talk to me. And that's why this all happened. So I was quite prepared to set the precedent. But, you know, these things absorb a lot of time and energy. And, you know, when you're in practice, that's a cost to the practice. But at the same time, it would be good for the profession to reset the rules. I mean, the rules exist, but unless they're actually enforced, you know, they're ignored and dismissed and it becomes normalised. This is the problem. A lot of architects who I spoke to, award-winning architects, ex-presidents of the Institute, were very supportive that I was doing this, although they were very, you know, doubtful that anything would happen. When I got the adjudication decision, they were surprised and happy about it. But appeal after appeal after appeal is expensive. And then in the end, you might lose the last appeal and all that money's gone. So,
For someone like myself who's not as experienced in that legal area, with the adjudication decision, what does that mean going forward? I mean, I'm not sure if you wanted to read it or if you wanted to summarise what that decision was.
Maybe I should just explain what happened. After the consultation, which I embarked upon with the other architect, who, as I said, behaved unconscionably. Yeah, they shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have just embarked on this without calling me, which is just good manners. And I would do the same. I have many times. But anyway, a lot of time was spent consulting with that architect and coming to a better outcome. When I realised, as I said before, that they went out to tender and essentially lied about not doing that, our course of action at that point was to submit a tax invoice for the time spent consulting. And it wasn't just a few hours. It was a consultation over many weeks and a couple of months. And I submitted the tax invoice for my time, which actually saved them a lot of money. But listening, but taking the advice and following the consultation, there was some economic benefit to the client. And they didn't, so we submitted a tax, I submitted a tax invoice, which they didn't pay. And that then triggered the action through security of payments, which we won. It was a black and white decision. In fact, the adjudicator was very critical of their behaviour, of their lack of good faith, and recognised the value that had been brought to the client's benefit. And that was a great result. But they then appealed that in the Supreme Court, and the Achilles heel was that the tax invoice that I submitted was from my company. And despite the fact that I'm the nominated architect and the sole director of that company, the technicality was that the moral rights rests with me, not the company. Mm. And mm-hmm. we may have even argued that in court, but we decided not to take the risk and to withdraw and then start the whole process again. And anyway, I won't go into the whole thing, but eventually we just decided, look, it's too much time and effort and money. The building had actually been protected and I just ran out of steam, you know. But unfortunately, because I think it's an important issue, I just couldn't on my own manage to, you know, set that precedent.
I still have steam.
Well, you need steam and money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know.
It's hard.
But what I wanted to add in there is one of the problems in this is the other architect who was involved is an architect well known in the profession.
Mm-hmm.
and he just forgot or didn't understand his obligation to Ed to notify him, or his obligation under the Act to notify him. That obligation falls on the owner to notify, and it also falls on the architect and any other one who's leading the team to notify. That's my reading of it. And that's created a bad taste, and it always will. At the moment, there's a fear of enforcing this sort of issue on whatever subject, and not just limited to moral rights, on what architects should do, because it causes problems. And yes, it's something that the profession generally has to face up to, that some people will have their noses rubbing in the dirt. It'll only be temporary. It'll be best for the profession. Now, from my point of view, the profession generally is suffering from an abusive relationship with its clients, with its client base. Mm. And that abusive relationship projects onto others. Now, what the Institute was concerned about was conflict between architects, and they were looking at a particular example. And if we make architects aware of their responsibilities, and if they do their responsibilities, once the architect in Ed's case knew about what the problem was, he acted scrupulously. Now, he's done something wrong, and like anyone who's faced a traffic fine or driving through a red light or speeding, you have to, it doesn't taint your reputation, but it means you've done something wrong and you should face up to it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. At the moment, because of the fears expressed by some senior members of the Institute, that doesn't happen. And that's something that the Institute has to overcome for it to address or service its members properly.
Yeah, so it's nothing personal, but and I haven't done that yet, but, you know, I really should, and I've been told by eminent other architects that I shouldn't just let it go for the sake of the profession.
The problem is that all these eminent other architects they have faced the same problem and will continue to face the same problem, and they don't want to stir the apple cart themselves. They're leading up to Ed. And I think one of the reasons why I continue to support Ed is because of the bravery and the morality of what he's been trying to do.
Mm. Because would you say that this is, does this come down to, and this is where I'm definitely testing my legal knowledge. Is this more of an ethics issue, or do you still say it rests with, is it tort, or is it?
I think it is. I think it's a moral or ethical issue. Look, I also think it's just good. It's just good manners. Look, I have on many times. Taken over a project where there was a previous architect. And the first thing I've done...
Expecting an architect to comply with a legal obligation is not an ethical or moral issue. It's just a legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
And by not notifying, that is a breach of a legal obligation set down at the beginning. I think it's in Section 89 or Section 9, Section 189 or 190 of the moral rights provisions of the Copyright Act.
Yeah, I suppose what I was saying is it's just, to me, it's just good manners. When I've been asked to take over a project where a new client has said, oh, we had another architect, we weren't very happy with them, we want you to do it, the first thing I have done on all of those occasions is to call that other architect, whether I knew them or not, to find out what happened. Whether they're owed money, why they've been sacked, what's the problem, before I put pen to paper. In this case, these other architects not just done the work, they've achieved the DA consent, which is a problem for me ongoing, because even though they haven't gone ahead with it, the consent exists, and it exists in perpetuity. Because they've actually built the building, the DA consent lives forever. So another board in 20 years' time could make the changes that were approved. So It's not that straightforward. And I think other architects, if they would just, well, they should be aware of the law, but I think it's a very, cute defense to say we made a mistake. I mean, it's a fundamental, it's like saying, you get in the car, oh, I didn't know that I needed a key. I mean, of course.
I guess it's, it's definitely a good reminder of what architects' obligations are. That during their existing conditions survey, or when they're initially coming on board with the project, if the client has even said, I was working with an architect before, and this is their name, and now I'd like to work with you, and things have fallen apart. And I think that's a really good reminder that all architects should be contacting the previous architect or finding out where the moral rights lie with any existing buildings that they may be making an impact on.
I think in my case, the other architect, they've been around a while. They are themselves award-winning. So I think they may have been asleep at the wheel, but they actually should have known. They weren't young or inexperienced, so it wasn't that they were ignorant. Anyway, whatever the reason is, the fact is that there was a breach and it should be addressed. So yeah. I now have the obligation to lodge a complaint and it should be addressed in the interests of this kind of thing not continuing to occur.
So I also understand the depth of the obligation, the depth of the rights within moral rights. Let's say things had been done appropriately on this particular project of yours, if the new architect had contacted you and said, what we're designing will impact your courtyard, and then they said, we're trying to design something that still respects your design. But then if you feel that their design has negatively impacted your work, do you have the rights to then refuse to approve their work or to approve the changes to your project?
No, I don't have the right to veto it, but I have the right to be consulted. And in the end, if they listen to what I say and then decide to do something else, they're entitled to do that. However, I at that point would be entitled to take my name off the building. If I think the building is so different to what I designed, I don't want to have my name associated with it, then I would do that. But that's the procedure. And I think that's a fair procedure, as long as everyone plays by the rules.
From the owner's point of view, what the concern is, the architect is going to do what you were just suggesting, to veto the work and cause extended delays. What Ed and the other architect did in his case was sit down, negotiate, come up with a solution, which was put forward to the board of that organisation in draft form, and they refused to handle it. They never responded to it.
Yeah, I was actually happy with the conclusion that I came to with the other architect. We jointly signed a report, and I was told that report went to the board. A few weeks later, I didn't hear from anyone. I contacted the president of the board, and just to ask him, just to inquire whether he'd received the report and whether they were adopting it, and he refused to talk to me. I got a very cute email back from him saying, thanks very much for the consultation. We've now heard what you had to say. We'll now decide what we'll do. And I thought that was disingenuous, and I was aware that they had lied to me about the tender, not going to tender, and so that's what triggered there was clearly a lack of good faith, and that's what then led to the legal action.
But the point is that developers are frightened with getting to the level that it got to. The reality, he should never have got there. No. If the two architects had spoken at the beginning, it would have just been a quiet discussion between the two architects and the matter would have been resolved. And the definition of professional has changed. One of the parts of the definition that I was taught was that what we do should be in the public good. If you have a look at the modern definition of professional in the Oxford Dictionary, which is, and I'm quoting an earlier Oxford Dictionary, definition of professional, that in the public good is no longer there. Because we now live in a transactional world that allows people like Donald Trump to rise to the position that he rose to, and he should never, and without that professionalism in there, and without the respect for professionals that used to be there, we allow people like him to rule us. And we're doing it here now with the developers who are dictating contracts that totally absolve them of any responsibility and transfer the responsibility down the line to the people who have no responsibility but who have to accept it because they enter into contracts that are totally enforceable because of the attitude of the courts.
Well, let me just come back to what I said earlier, that I think it's very corrosive. We do live in an environment where economics is a factor, and any practicing architect understands and accepts that. However, we've also got a responsibility to protect the environment and the quality of buildings. And I don't see economic feasibility as something which is necessarily at odds with good architecture. The case of the MLC Centre is a good example. So I think the perception that an architect will want to veto the client is really bad for architects, and we've got to rise above that and demonstrate that we can and we do produce good economic outcomes as well as good architecture, good aesthetics, good environmental outcomes. The two things should not be mutually exclusive.
This belief that we want, that we as architects want to control everything, is endemic in the industry, and it gets down to what the fear that builders have of architects not accepting what they do and wanting the thing to be changed, and that's a real fear that builders have and subcontractors have, and the client have, because that's what they're told by project managers. So.
Yeah.
Project managers say
often, not always, but often.
They often say there's a I attended a conference some years ago, which was run by the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, and when I stood up for architects in the discussion sessions that we had, I was attacked by people who were project managers on the basis. You architects just want to control everything. You don't allow the builder to do what he knows best. And that gets back to the problem that all architects face. Subcontractors know more than anyone, and let the subcontractor decide how to design the building.
Well, yeah, it's a bit like a symphony orchestra. And unfortunately, or a film director, architects these days, and there's so much new technology and so much more information that it's not easy. We're in a profession where there's so much information, so much technology and knowledge, and somehow we need to be able to harness and, be aware of all that and produce a beautiful piece of music or a beautiful film and one that's also a good economic outcome for a developer, and we do that. I mean, most good practices are able to do that. But as Peter says, there is a perception in some quarters the architect's the problem. They're a prima donna. They only want to control their building and the arrogance and all that stuff, and we'll suffer because we're paying for it. We have to overcome that. And at the same time, we have to deal with these contracts which extinguish our rights. That is really bad for us, and it's something that we need to address.
The board found to, I think, is what architects are trying to do is to comply with their briefs. What the developer wants to do once he's got the completed design is how can I make it cheaper? And they're the two conflicting.
Well, I often. Again, as a practicing architect, can you know, if one can have the dialogue with the client where we can produce a cheaper or lower cost design, and then look at what's the value of that in terms of its economic value, or the rentability of it, or the sale price of it, or, you know, it can be tested. And you can spend less money and get a cheaper outcome, or you can spend a bit more money and get a higher return. So I think we need to be aware of that cheap is not necessarily bad. Low buildings can be very good. I personally don't have a problem with that. But at the same time, you've got to hit the sweet spot where the cost of the building is actually a good investment. And it's not necessarily the cheapest. It's not necessarily the most expensive either. But we as architects need to be part of that dialogue with the property industry and developers and project managers. But, as Peter said, often we're marginalised. The cost of the architect is a line item on the bottom of the project cost, often at the very bottom of the project cost. And we're perceived as being an expense to the project rather than a value to the project.
And people understand what the architectural method is. They don't understand that architects apply it and that the architectural method is a definition of the processes that we follow, whatever we want forward. And it's a defined process, and it's practiced by all sorts of industry and all sorts of activities. And I always quote to people Angela Merkel's definition of the architecture of the New Europe and Wayne Swan's definition of the architecture of the Australian tax system as an example that it's a lot broader than architecture.
Absolutely.
That's the sort of that's one thing that we've forgot to say. When it went to court, the basis of going to court, the basis of putting it to adjudication, was that in the Copyright Act, in the moral rights provisions, there is a specific section. I can't think of the exact number. It comes after 195AT, where it says that you have the right to go to court to get compensation for the loss and expense that you incurred, amongst other things. You can seek injunctions to prevent a continuation, subject to what the Act says. And that right establishes the character of the consultation as a contractual relationship. And the use of the term good faith also adds to that, because good faith is a term used in contracts. So you put all of that together, you then have a contract. And if the contract in relation to building, you can take it from the federal legislation into the state legislation and have the matter adjudicated. And the technical fight that we had with the other side, who was also an architect lawyer involved, the technical fight, that's why resolved itself into a technical fight, argued that you couldn't do that with federal legislation.
Right.
Which is not correct, but that was the argument.
Right. Oh, gosh. So it gets down to the nuts and bolts of definitions, which must get, frustrating and draw things out a lot for lawyers, especially like when we're getting down to all of these, different takes and semantics on language. So I'm sure that would have been extremely frustrating to get to that point. We've unfortunately run out of time for our recording today, but it was absolutely wonderful, I think, to talk with both of you about the intricacies of moral rights and also the obligations that architects have to each other on the projects that we're working on. And I think it's, Ed, you make a good point that having good manners and finding out whose work you might be impacting before you get too far down the process is a really great thing that other architects could put into their process and make sure that it's just part of due course.
Thanks very much. I just want to thank you very much for hosting the podcast. and just to encourage other architects to find out more, be more aware of what their rights are.
Absolutely. But thank you so much, Ed and Peter, for joining me today. And I look forward to hearing how the rest of your work progresses in the future, and we'd love to talk to you again.
Thanks, Daddy.
This has been Hearing Architecture, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to our guests, registered architects Ed Lippman, Director of Lippman Partnership, and Peter Sarlos of Sydney East Architects. Thank you so much for sharing your case study on moral rights with us. We look forward to hearing from you again in the future. If listeners would like to know more about moral rights, copyright laws, and the various codes of conduct relevant to architects, please feel free to visit the Australian Institute of Architects Acumen website at acumen.architecture.com.au to search and download all the relevant practice notes. Our sponsor Brickworks also produce architecture podcasts hosted by Tim Ross. You can find The Art of Living, Architects Abroad, and The Power of Two at brickworks.com.au or your favourite podcast platform. If you'd like to show your support, please rate, review, and subscribe to Hearing Architecture in your favourite podcast app. If you want to know more about what the Australian Institute of Architects is doing to support architects and the community, please visit architecture.com.au. This is a production by the Australian Institute of Architects Emerging Architects and Graduates Network in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. The Institute production team was Madeline Jenkins and Claudia McCarthy, and the Imagine production team was Daniel Moore. This content is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Architects Emerging Architects and Graduates Network in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. This content does not take into account specific circumstances and should not be relied on in that way. This content does not constitute legal, financial, insurance, or other types of advice. You should seek independent verification or advice before relying on this content in circumstances where loss or damage may result. The Institute endeavours to publish content that is accurate at the time it is published, but does not accept responsibility for content that may or will become inaccurate over time.